Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike Vassaf, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest this week is John Burleyoung, former U.S. Army tank crewman and R&D supervisor at New West Genetics, a Colorado-based company developing and improving industrial hemp genetics for adaption to various regions in the U.S. They combine traditional plant breeding with modern genetics to create stable, optimized traits and varieties adapted for large-scale production. John grew up in an austere household in the suburbs of Louisville, Kentucky in the 80s, when kids could disappear for hours at a time without a cell phone and explore the boundaries of their environment, create adventures, and be exposed to risk without a safety net. His brother joined the Army when he was young, and John lived vicariously through him, including his experiences during the first Gulf War. This and 9/11 were all the influence John needed to join the Army after high school, where he also served as a tank crew member. Like his brother, John was involved in an invasion of Iraq, this one in 2003. In this episode, John describes those experiences over a 15-month period and how there was a constant need to adapt to the changing mission, enemy, and environment. This ability to adapt to changing situations is absolutely something John brought forward with him following his military career. In this episode, John talks about how he's applied those skills to the private sector, from being a mud logger on an oil rig, earning his master's in soil science, and supporting hemp genetic development with New West Genetics.
Well, I was born in Louisville, Kentucky. I grew up there, you know, from birth up until I, you know, turned 18. And we weren't a terribly wealthy family, but, we had everything we needed. So it was a pretty low stress, but, austere childhood. But it was back in the 80s when it was okay for kids to go out and play on their own from 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. and not check in or anything, and no cell phones and all that. So I definitely adventured quite a bit. And that was my upbringing.
Was there any ag influence in that upbringing in Louisville?
Not at all. My parents were my dad was in philosophy and my mom was in marketing. So, you know, and we lived in very, you know, definitely in the real urban environment. You know, this wasn't any suburbia type of, upbringing. So really farms were someplace that I had to go out of my way to see. And, you know, we would do that periodically. We'd go take road trips in the summer when my mom had some time off. Mm-hmm. And that was the most farms I ever saw was on road trips like that.
Is there a particular, story of that early upbringing from sunup to sundark where you were out on your own that you can kind of particularly remember that, instilled in something with you or them that stuck with you today? Because it's unusual in today's environment.
Yeah. I remember when I got my first mountain bike. I was 8 or 9 years old, something like that. And I got a mountain bike that I could change gears. And that just opened up the world to me. And because I could climb the hills, I could go on these crazy trails back in the woods. And so that really, really, I think had an influence on my, wanderlust that would take up a large part of my adult life too. So
the military, can you give us a sense of how that became an interest for you?
When I was growing up, I sort of became interested in, I thought machines were really cool. I watched auto racing. I liked Formula One and NASCAR and stuff like that. And I always, I love trains when I was a kid, and there's just something about, big machines that made a lot of noise and blew exhaust everywhere just really appealed to me as a kid. And when my brother joined the army, and next thing I knew, he was participating in the Gulf War. He was a Bradley crew member at that time. So just seeing that, I was like, whoa, that is the coolest thing ever. And watching the tanks, all the video of tanks, driving across the desert, like that was, I was still pretty young then, but I sort of, from that age, I started thinking like, man, that is really cool. And I kind of want to do that. So yeah. My brother stayed in the army through the whole time that I was growing up, so I was exposed to it a lot. And then when September 11th happened and I was a senior in high school, it was like, well, I know what I'm doing now. So
How much interaction did you have with him as a Bradley crew member, which for those who may not know is a tank? How much interaction did you have with him as a crewman during the Gulf War?
None at all. I mean, I was back in Kentucky. I guess I was what? I was like 10 years old, something like that. Something, 11. And he was in Kuwait. So the most that we could communicate was by mail. And there was very little of that going on because he was really busy.
When you decided after September 11th to join, did you also want to follow in his footsteps into the tank community, or did you go somewhere else?
Well, yeah, I became an Abrams tank crew member, so a little heavier fighting vehicle, but they go to the same, they're both trained at the same school in Fort Knox, and they work together quite a bit. So yeah, I had some time and a little some expert knowledge from my brother here and there to help me decide what exactly it was that I wanted to do. But yeah, the Abrams tank was just such a cool thing. And I had to do it. So.
As somebody was in the infantry but not in tanks, can you give us a sense of what a crewman's responsibility was for that piece of machinery?
Yeah, I mean, there's three essential positions, and then there's sort of a fourth nice to have position. So I was mostly a driver. I kind of had an aptitude for that, and I really enjoyed driving. But I also spent some time as a loader, which is the sort of the nice to have, but not completely essential position.
Explain that, John, what a loader is.
Well, the loader is in combat, the loader is inside the turret, feeding ammunition into the main gun because it does not have an automatic loading system, and the ammunition is stored in the back of the turret for safety reasons, and so it has to travel through the turret into the front to get into the cannon, and so that the loader basically just stands there and just rotates 180 degrees, just slinging ammunition into the cannon. And the reason I say it's not completely essential is because you could have the gunner move into the loader's position, and then the commander can do almost everything that the gunner can do. So the loader is it's usually a jun what you know the most junior person on the tank.
Describe what it's like to drive one of those things.
All right, it's a lot of fun. people
is it a some kind of like toggle, or are you moving levers back and forth like on a bulldozer?
it's honestly, the controls are an awful lot like sort of like a motorcycle or a mountain bike, where you've got a handlebar. They call it a T-bar, but it's just a handlebar with grips that rotate. And so you just, like a motorcycle, if you want to give it more throttle, you just twist the grips back. And so yeah, that's it. It's real intuitive. It's it's a little awkward when you're reversing because the controls also reverse. So, you know, when you think you're going forward,
like backing
right,
up a trailer.
Yeah, it takes a lot of training and muscle memory to be competent at it. And but I mean, it's otherwise it's really easy. It's an automatic transmission, and there, you know, since the throttle is on your grips, there's only one pedal that you have to worry about. That's the brakes. So, you know, everything is, it's actually really comfortable.
Can you give us a sense of what your, you know, early career was like as a tank crewman and as a driver? Where'd you deploy? What was that like for you?
Yeah, well, I knew that when I joined the Army, I pretty much would refuse if they didn't send me to get stationed somewhere in Germany because I wanted the ability to travel. So I was stationed in a small town called Büdingen in Germany, which is, if you know where Frankfurt is, it's mm-hmm. about an hour north of Frankfurt, roughly. So I was there for about 3 months, and then we were off to Kuwait. So I barely had any time to get to know my platoon, much less, you know, learn everything they don't teach you in basic training up the tank. And so it was very much a hit the ground running experience. And, you know, before I knew it, I wasn't in the first push, but I was part of the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Hmm. And that was pretty wild experience for an 18-year-old who had only worked in pizza places and stuff previous to that.
I was going to ask you about what time frame that was, and I thought it might have been around that. But to the extent that you can, John, I mean, explain what that was like. Do you have a particular story that, you know, really resonates with you today that you can share that will help give us a sense of what it was like and what you learned and what those experiences were?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I fully expected that I was going to be, you know, because as a tanker, you know, and I ended up in a cavalry squadron, and in Army doctrine, cavalry is often the first people that they send in to sort of make contact, figure out where the enemy is, and then we send all the rest of the troops that way. And so, you know, I sort of knew that and expected that I was going to be doing a lot more shooting than I did, which was, you know, which was none, because, you know, like I said, I was about a week behind it might have been a little bit more than a week, but, you know, it was behind the main push. So the vast majority of the fighting had already been done by the time that my tanks, you know, my squadron, I was in a 1-1 cavalry, and our squadron was all lined up on the back of vehicles. And we spent all this time like, okay, if we take contact, we're going to break the chains that lock our vehicles down, and we're just going to roll off and start fighting. And so we were all hyped up, and we had this great plan. And then, you know, it was like 8 hours of dust storms and just like constantly breaking down because the vehicle's tires were, you know, the tires were popping and just all sorts of just dumb, just like, this is everything that I did not expect it to be. And, you know, after many complications, something that should have been simple ended up taking close to a week. And by the time we got there, it was just like, you know, well, hey guys, what did we miss? And, you know, oh yeah, nothing. So, you know, it was very anticlimactic. Of course, once I got into Baghdad, things changed, but that was a great, like, introduction to, hey, this is what the Army is actually like. And it did definitely set the tone for the rest of the deployment.
We used to always call it hurry up and wait.
Oh, yes.
There's a lot of that.
Oh, there was too much of that.
You said things changed when you got into Baghdad. How?
Well, I mean, it was sitting on the back of a truck, just watching terrain go by. And then when we got into Baghdad, Oh yeah, there's a war going on here because, like, we ended up staying on we stayed in an abandoned, not fully completed gas power plant for almost 3 months. We had nothing. There was no electricity. There was no running water. You know, everything had to be brought into us on, you know, by convoys. And there, that was not very peaceful. There were IEDs, you know, improvised explosive devices all over the place. You know, our tanks were often tasked out to do additional duties above and beyond the, like, the patrolling, you know, the presence patrolling and stuff was sort of what we were tasked to do early on. But then, you know, Army Rangers and Green Berets and people would come up every now and then and say, "Hey, we need you to provide security for us while we go kick in some doors or whatever." And so, yeah, then I got to see the other side of Army life, which was, like, you know, all of the things that they don't tell you about in basic training and the things that they didn't know were going to happen when we were spinning up in Grafenwöhr in Germany. And so everyone there was learning, you know, like, oh wow, so this is not one of us was trained or prepared for this.
So what did the rest of that look like, John? I mean, you spent 3 months there. I assume the rest of the you were there for a year, 7 months, 6 months, and then you came home.
Well, I was there for 12 months and then got extended for three more when we were at the airport. You know, waiting to fly out, we got extended for another 3 months. So I ended up there for like 15 and some change. But yeah, that was, I did so much. There were some, you know, my mission changed monthly where, you know, for a while I was doing guard duty on, we called it BIOP, Baghdad International Airport. So I did guard duty there for a while. Then we were a quick response force for, you know, a pretty large portion of southern Baghdad and getting down into the Sunni Triangle, you know, south of there. And so, you know, for a while we were getting called up and go, you know, getting sent 30 miles away to go do something in some tiny little farming village. And then for a couple of months, we escorted around explosive ordnance disposal people. And, you know, for kind of a similar reason that I talked about earlier, you know, we were, if you're going to go out someplace where there's potentially lots of big booms, you bring a tank, you know, something that if it's, if something's going to get blown up, you're most survivable in a tank. And so we would escort those folks around. And, yeah, we needed armor for that. There were a few close calls, but, then it was presence patrols, and then it was, oh hey, it's too expensive to maintain the engines. Here's a Humvee. And
Oh
then,
no.
yeah, did several months of that, and just lots of various different army things.
The thing I keep hearing in your stories, John, is this need to be adaptable, right? And learn on the fly as your situations present themselves, both when you first get there and your expectations aren't what you thought, and then over the course of a 15-month deployment, how much your mission and your geography and everything in your environment changes.
Well, I mean, that's absolutely correct. You know, I mean, none of us, when we were training up for this, we were doing all of the Cold War, you know, we're going to fight a battalion of Russian T-72s, and it's going to happen in this, you know, one of eight different ways that we've been preparing for. And that didn't happen. And then we thought that there was going to be weapons of mass destruction and all of this, you know, chemical weapons and things, and then none of that happened. And you know, like, everything that we planned for basically happened in like the first 2 weeks of hostilities. And then it was, you know, for the rest of that deployment, just like, you know, needing to be agile and learning the importance of we used to say two is one and one is none. And so bringing lots of extra supplies, because that 4 hour presence patrol that you went on turned into a 26 hour mission that, you know, chasing around someone. And so, yeah. And it was very much required, a lot of adaptability and thinking on the fly. And that absolutely has had an effect on me, and my career outside of the Army.
Let's talk about that career, John, outside the Army. How did you ultimately get into what I think was first geology and earth science? Where did this interest in sort of environmental stewardship and the protection of natural resources, where do you think that interest came from?
I didn't mention this, but I'm an Eagle Scout. And so that was part of my upbringing. Was I was super active in Boy Scouts. And so our troop was, again, it wasn't the most well-funded troop, but we knew how to go camping on a budget. And we monthly there would be some sort of weekend long excursion where we'd go somewhere. Either there was a private camp that was frequently used by Boy Scouts in Southern Indiana that we went to quite a bit. And then just Kentucky is full of, there's so much natural beauty. There's state and national parks all over the place.
So your undergraduate was in geology. And then I also think I understand you have a master's from Colorado State in soil and crop science. Is that correct?
All right. So I kind of, when I got out of the Army, I did a 3-year enlistment. And then when, you know, I didn't get the traveling bug out of my blood at that point. You know, the Army life wasn't my style, but I knew that traveling around and seeing the world still had to happen. So I ended up doing a lot of, I chased music festivals quite a bit, and might have had something to do with why it took 6 years to get my bachelor's degree. Yeah, I traveled quite a bit, then I got called back into the Army. I got IRR recalled in 2010, and they sent me back to Baghdad, and so that put things on a little bit of a delay. But when I was sitting in guard towers for that next 9 months, I got to thinking, like, okay, you know, I was really solidifying my plans, because I was still a year and a half away from finishing my bachelor's degree at that point. I really ironed it out, like, I'm going to finish my geology degree. I'm going to get a job working in the oil industry for a little while, just to make some money, honestly. And it was kind of a childhood dream, almost like a bucket list, was to work on a drilling rig. Going back to that theme of liking the environment of being around big machinery, well, you know, a drilling rig has got plenty of that. And so I was planning it all out. I was going to be a geologist for an oil company for a while, save up some money, and then shift things back over towards the environmental side once I'd kind of gotten that, once I'd scratched that itch. So, yeah, finished my bachelor's degree. Yeah, it pretty much did. I finished my bachelor's degree and then immediately got a job on a drilling rig. The job was, you know, we called ourselves field geologists, but if you know anything about the oil field, I was a mud logger, which is like, you know, it's not a super prestigious job. I was there for a little over a year and I ended up in Wyoming, and that was the real first connection to Colorado that I had, because I started snowboarding then. So I would, on my time off, I would go down to the mountains in Colorado and learn to ride my snowboard. And so after I quit that job, I decided, well, you know, maybe geology degree isn't enough to get me into the career I want. So I'm going to have to go to grad school And I thought, well, if I'm gonna be in grad school, I might as well go someplace where I can ride my snowboard. And so that's basically what happened. I picked a couple of schools and I got into CSU, and yeah.
So how did you ultimately get plugged into where you are now with New West Genetics?
Well, I wanted to make sure that I finished writing my master's thesis before I made any serious attempts to find work.
Okay.
I was taking odd jobs, like, you know, month-long field season, you know, a lab needs some help out at a research plot, and I'd go in and would, you know, help pull weeds or go collect data, help with harvest, stuff like that. And I did that for a couple different labs, and one of them I ended up working for several times. It turned out was run by a professor who also was doing research in hemp on the commercial side. And so when I saw an internship posting that they had put up, they were emailing out onto the, you know, like the graduate student email lists, they would put out job offers, and I saw an internship for this, for New West Genetics, and I thought, well, heck, you know, this would be a pretty good piece of exposure to the ag side of things, because I felt like my soil science education was pretty good, but I was starting to recognize I needed to know a little bit more about the plant side of things if I really wanted to be successful. And so I thought, heck, I mean, I've already been around a few ag fields, so I kind of know what the work is like. I can, you know, I can give this internship a go. And so, yeah, 5 years later.
why do you think, John, it's taken us so long to begin to recognize the value and the importance of the soil part of cultivation and the microbiome that's necessary for plant cultivation? Was it kind of one of those things where it was just out of sight, so to speak, out of mind, or we were only focusing on what was above the soil and just paid no mind to what was below it? Why has it taken us so long to recognize how important soil is in this process?
I feel like maybe from my perspective, maybe there's two things that happened. Number one is soil is kind of hard to study. Just by its nature, you have to mess it up if you want to learn about something in it. You know, if I want to know something about the soil chemistry, well, I have to go out there and dig a hole, you know, so now I'm disturbing that environment, and I'm changing to some degree the conditions of the sample that I've taken. And then I have to go and do chemistry tests on it, which completely, you know, I can't do anything else with the sample now, because I've subdivided it into a bunch of parts and I've done a bunch of different tests. And so now that I know about this piece of soil, it now does not exist because soil is extremely variable across space. And so, okay, I can dig a hole and test the soil in this part of the field, but I can walk 10 feet over to the east and the conditions are very different. Also, you know, society, you know, there's sort of, you know, it's taken people a little while, but people are starting to come around to the idea that climate change is real, and they're sort of getting their eyes opened up to all of the various ways that our environments are being degraded. And you know, you see a big landslide, or you see a big flood, or you know, there's a drought or something, and soil is got, you know, it's playing a part in all of these. And you know, now people are, you know, again with increased ability to detect and learn about properties of the soil, we're learning that it's a whole lot more than just dirt. There's quite a bit of life going on in that little 1 gram piece of soil you've got in your hand. And And now that we know that, and now that we're becoming more sensitive to climate change and those related issues, I think that people are starting to pay a little more attention to soil.
I have heard this concept that there are physical components within soil that has tangible benefits if absorbed through the skin for calming mental health benefits, and that the physical act of being in soil, physically contacting it, has benefits for veterans suffering from certain mental health issues. Have you ever heard this? If you have heard it, does it have any merit scientifically? What are your thoughts there?
The first time I heard of this was in 2007. I spent a month doing ecotourism, ironically enough, on the opposite side of the planet in New Zealand. There was one of the people that my group volunteered for was a guy who had a piece of land. He was converting what had been grazed out sheep pasture, and he was trying to convert it back to native forest. And he almost exclusively employed people who had some sort of cognitive disability impairment. They had an injury or birth defect or something. And he was giving these people work. They were running the greenhouses. They were doing all of the horticulture, you know, they're starting and raising all of the seedlings that would then get transplanted into the fields. And he had this idea that getting soil under your fingernails and then getting that soil into your body somehow, you know, maybe you're not washing your hands as well as you should have after, you know, or before you eat a sandwich, well, on your lunch break or whatever, but in some way or another, you're getting this soil into your body, and it's bringing whatever microbes, whatever that microbiome is, you're sort of inoculating yourself with a dose of that. And so that was the first time I heard of it.
Now, it's an interesting perspective. I hadn't heard it explained that way. In the impact is not necessarily on perhaps the environmental conditions and the fact that you're out in the sun, but perhaps ingesting it in some way has an impact on gut biome. If I can bring it back, John, to New West Genetics and hemp production, is there something unique that happens in hemp cultivation that's either a benefit or a detriment to the soil in which it's cultivated?
Well, I haven't, my work responsibilities, I haven't done a lot of investigation of soil. That is actually something we're going to be doing here soon. It's an important, you know, understanding what the plant is doing to our soil is important, but early on in a crop breeding program, there's other things that are more important that we need to focus on with the limited resources that we have. And so, you know, that's, like I said, that's something that we are going to begin doing, but it's not something I've done previously.
Okay.
So with that caveat, then, I think hemp can be a net positive to the soil when you're applying the correct agronomy to it. You know, if once we figure out optimal row spacings and planting densities and things like that, hemp can compete with weeds pretty it can outcompete weeds. It just needs a little bit of a head start, and so if you manage the crop correctly, it can get ahead of the weeds, and then you don't have to drive through and spray or you know, have tractor passes with all of the mechanical cultivation, and so you're potentially burning less fuel, you're compacting your soil less, you're damaging soil structure less, you're harming soil microbiota less. And so I just think that that really rugged, hardy, and competitive nature of hemp can give you a lot of knock-on benefits once people figure out, you know, the optimal way to do it.
To the extent that you can comment on this, John, I'd be interested to hear from your perspective the way that New West Genetics is competing with other hemp seed cultivation and genetics companies. How are you guys doing this process differently and in a more advantageous way?
Well, I mean, for one, you know, I think that the people are the biggest asset that we have. We have a really small team, but every one of us that's involved with the research and development side of things has a graduate degree in either directly related science or, you know, like myself, you know, I have a graduate degree in soil science with plenty of, with experience in agriculture prior to coming here. So between the education and then the 60 something, you know, years of experience between the various members of the company, you know, I think that we kind of know the correct way to do it because we understand the industry, we understand other crops. And so we're taking a systematic approach. We use best practices from, anytime the scientific community learns something about, crop improvement or genetics or whatnot, well, we are learning that also, and we're applying those techniques also. You know, we're not doing anything super fancy. we're not doing transgenics or anything like that. We use traditional plant breeding methods, but they're informed by the latest science, and you know, we understand how to do the this maybe in a way that other people have maybe they have the ability to, but maybe not the depth and breadth of experience that we have.
If I'm understanding correctly, John, and please tell me if this is outside the wheelhouse or not, but you guys have figured out a way to essentially create more female plants relative to male, which has better hemp properties. That species of, or that gender of plant has a better species property of male. Therefore, at the end, you get higher yields. Is that fundamentally correct, or do I have that messed up?
Yeah, I mean, so the female plant produces the vast majority of the economically viable products that people want from hemp. It depends on what you're going after. If you want males at all, early on people were breeding for CBD, and so they wanted no males, and they would go through and either chemically induce their seeds to or their plants to produce female seeds, or they would just manually go through and rogue males. Well, that's really labor intensive. Also, if you're going to do something other than CBD, so if you want grain, for example, then you do want males, but you only want enough males to pollinate the females, because when the males are done, once they've pollinated the females, they die, and all that you might have left is some, maybe some fiber, but it's really, they're not even very good for that, as, you know, according to my understanding, that we're just now sort of getting into fiber ourselves. So with that being said, we are working on a gender-skewed variety of hemp. But again, we're not, we're using traditional breeding methods. So we're just, we've found a line of genetics is skewed in one direction towards females. And so we're just using breeding and selection and lots of greenhouse time, getting that percentage up to where we think will be an optimal ratio of females to males.
As a final question, if I may, Is there anything, either through your work at New West Genetics or through your transition story that you've shared, is there anything that I'm not asking you that I should be? Lesson learned or an insight, anything that that we haven't talked about that you think is worth sharing here?
I feel like, you know, I didn't really spend that much time in the Army. I kind of got in, I didn't dislike my time, but I also, you know, it just wasn't the long-term solution for me. But holy cow, it had a massive influence on my life over time. And I guess I like to say that, you know, I think it's an experience that almost anyone can benefit from, but it's up to them how they apply themselves and apply the lessons that they learn. You know, it's you may not have it in you to stay in for a 30-year lifer career, but, you know, 3 years can probably manage that. And there's so much to gain out of that experience that's, you know, it's you know, I lived probably 10 years of experiences in that 3 years of active duty that I was, you know, that I served.
John's stories from this episode were truly a culmination of experiences. As he put it, he lived 10 years of experiences and 3 years of active duty time. But not just in his military career, but in the time that followed as well. Each of these experiences, at least to me, felt like a trial period for John. Is this the right area for me? Should I be here? What should I learn? But in each of these experiences, John brought with him this ability to adapt and be flexible, skills he learned originally from his military career. And then from each of these experiences, John learned something and carried it forward with him. I think it can be too easy to equate these trial periods in our lives as failure, but I don't at all think that's how John viewed them. Rather, I think he sees them as opportunities to grow and learn more about himself. As John admits, what New West Genetics is doing in the hemp sector is not the sexiest of sciences, but they're doing it in a systematic, scientifically supported way, always feeding back into the system what the community and professionals around them are learning. Their team is full of technical experts, constantly learning from each other and applying good science to create a niche in the marketplace. If you're interested in learning more about what they're doing, don't hesitate to reach out. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these stories and insights, please leave us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website at agdconsult.com. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Dessa, and until next time, stay frosty.